Welcome to Let's Talk. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you, and welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service, and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Amy McGuire, my co-host in the studio with me. Morning, Amy. How are you?
Good morning. I'm very well, thank you, Tiger. How are you?
Oh, I'm real well.
Nice
it's Friday.
Nice for a Friday, yes.
I'm real well. It's Friday. Now, tell us about our guest who's on the line waiting for us.
Well, I'm very excited about this next guest. It's Marima Fox. She's a co-leader of the Maori Party. She's been the leader of the Maori Party since 2014, and she's a very respected leader over in Aotearoa. Not only has she had a long history in the education field and was recently the advisor to the Minister for Education, but she's also a mother of 9 children. So I think it'll be a very interesting chat to look at the similarities but also the differences between Australia and New Zealand, especially considering we have this constant controversy over racism in the wake of Adam Good. So I think it'll be a very good chat. I'm really excited about it today.
Well, it is good to connect up with leader of the party, co-leader. I think you have two leaders of the Māori Party. But Marima Fox, welcome to the program. It's really good to have you on our talk show over here in Let's Talk in Brisbane.
Thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure and a great honour to be with you. And just on the issue of the co-leaders, so the Greens Party in New Zealand were the first party to have co-leadership, so male-female co-leadership. When the Māori Party was established, it was a fundamental policy and written into our constitution that we would have male-female co-leadership, and not just because of gender balance, but because of the cultural aspects that that brings to our party. So just a little bit of explanation there for you. We call it Māreikura and Whatukura, that there is I guess male learning or men's learning within Māori culture, and also women's learning within Māori culture, and together that forms a balance of the way we like to operate here in Aotearoa and within our party. So it's a great pleasure to be with you, and I just want to pay my respects to the traditional people of your lands, and in Māori we call that the tangata moi moi are, or the dreaming people. So thank you for inviting me. It's great to be here.
We thank you for giving us your time. And time would be not of a great supply for you to do a lot. You wouldn't have a lot of time. So you have a lot of work to squeeze in the time that you have. So we really appreciate you giving us your time today.
No problem at all.
You recently celebrated, early a couple of weeks back, the 11th anniversary of the establishment of the party. Tell us about why the party was established.
Well, there's quite a history to it. The Labor government in 2004 were proposing to change a law, the foreshore and seabed legislation, to ensure that the seabed and the foreshore, meaning the beaches, and were the property of all New Zealanders. Māori were trying to claim at the time that actually we have a right over the foreshore and seabed as tangata whenua, as the traditional people of the land, as our traditional spaces. Now, we're guaranteed under the treaty all your land. And the government was trying to say, well, that doesn't include how can you claim what's under the sea. And it came about because there was a tribe who lived in the South Island, at the top of the South Island, who wanted to put mussel beds out the front of their traditional marae, or their ancestral land, so that they could make some money for the people and help sustain their lands and their families. So they petitioned to the local council, and the council denied them the right to do that. They said, but that's our bay. We've been here forever. We've lived here forever. And you let farmers do that. So there were farmers all around the Marlborough Sounds who put mussel beds down in the bays around their farms and don't have an issue with that. And so the local council said, but that's not your land, that's public land. They said, well, no, it's not. We've been here forever. We've fished here forever. We've collected food here forever. And we've lived here forever. And so they said, we're going to take you to court. Now, when that court case started to go through to the High Court, the government of the day under Helen Clark, Labor government, got worried about that. They thought, if this goes through, every Māori person in the country is going to stop people going to the beach. And so they started a bit of... Exactly.
That's so similar to Australia.
Yeah. Oh, hello, right? Same story, same stories. And so they changed the law, and Tariana Tūria at the time said, I can't vote for this. If you change the law, you are denying our people what is rightfully theirs. And Māori people don't stop people going to the beach. That's just insanity. You know where you can't go to the beach in New Zealand? Where it's privately owned.
Well, what, man, largely?
Kia ora. Pretty much. That's it. Marinas. Rich people who own whole islands, you can sail around them, but you can't put your feet on them, all of those sorts of things. And so the fear that was drummed up, you start talking about it and everybody latches onto it and the media jump all over it and strikes up this fear. Well, Tariana crossed the floor, 40,000, I estimate, people marched on Parliament from all around Māori, from all around New Zealand, all came to the same place and told the government that this is not right. Tariana crossed the floor. She was promptly thrown out of the party and then started our party, the Māori Party, to represent the rights of Indigenous people and the voice of Indigenous people. And that's what we still purport to do today.
And I guess we should explain to our listeners that in New Zealand, they actually have two electorates. You've got the general electorates and the Māori electorates. Was Tariana elected to the Māori electorates when she was in the Labour Party, or was it?
Yeah, she was.
Oh, right, okay.
So, yeah, so she stood in Te Tai Hauauru. Oh, actually, I might have to check on that. My understanding is that she did. She might not have. She might have won her seat outright. But when she came into the Māori Party, certainly she stood in the Māori electorate. And we, in our first election, I think, had four of those seats, and the next election had five. But we've lost support since because we chose to go into a coalition agreement, which we call the Relationship Accord, an agreement of confidence and supply with the national government. And people go, oh, you've sold us out to the national government. Well, that's not true at all. What we do is we have the independence to vote against the government. So we have the ability to do that. And we're allowed to do that. But we also have the ability to work from within the government to try and get change and make change and get gains for our people, and we do that as well. So we have a minister, Tūturu Flavel, who is my co-leader, has been in the party for 9 years as a member of parliament. He is the Minister of Māori Development and Associate Minister of Economic Development, and also the Minister of Whānau Ora.
That's very interesting. So I find it, when the Māori Party actually won those four seats in the original election, that was very much a vote in favour, or almost like sort of a mandate from Māori over the foreshore and seabed legislation. In Australia, we have nothing like that. We have no ability to form our own parties, in a sense. We have none of that political capital that the Māori Party have been able to build in the history of the Māori seats, and I know they've been quite controversial. I mean, how important is that representation, do you think?
Before you go there, you've also got a bigger population of Māori.
Of Māori people. So we
what
have
is the percentage
about 800,000. I think it's about 800,000.
What's 15%. That, 5%? 15%, right? Yeah.
15%. Yeah, we're tiny. New Zealand's only got 4 million people.
Yep.
So
right.
4.6 now. So I think it's about, we're sitting at 15%. Mm. But 1 in 6 Māori actually live in Australia. So I recently went over there, spent some time in Gold Coast in Brisbane, and was really enlightening. Met with a number of community groups and got a feel for how things were for Māori living in Australia at the moment. One woman who was there worked in a local school, high school, so 2,500 students in the school, 800 of them were Māori.
Wow.
So not just New Zealanders, but Māori in this one school. And so what some of the issues that they have there since the changing of the legislation is that those students now are starting to have behavioural problems because they don't see the point of going on to do their qualifications in senior school because they can't go to tertiary education. They can't go to tertiary education, or they can, but they have to pay for it outright. They're not entitled anymore under the change of legislation in 2001 to get a student loan. And so we've got a whole lot of issues. One girl who was Māori, who had been the ducks in one school in Australia, couldn't then go on to university.
Oh, wow.
Right.
Exactly. So there are a whole lot of issues and things going on for Māori there. But if we get back to that question about representation, now, when New Zealand was colonised and they established the government and who was voting at the time, it was men only were allowed to vote, but not just men. You had to be a landowner, so they brought that system in from England. But, see, Māori have a communal ownership of land, which meant every man in the tribe owned the land. And so if they allowed that to happen, then they could be outvoted in the different seats and different electorates. So what they did is they ring-fenced the Māori vote by saying you can only vote for these four regions, north, south, east and west. So they started the Māori electorate. If you were Māori, you were only able to vote in the Māori electorate and we had four seats. And that way we couldn't have a majority parliament of Māori people.
So in a way, it was a way to keep Māori out of the political process, those original Māori seats.
Absolutely. So, but, you know, we always like to hijack the process and put it to best use. And so now the Māori seats are tied to census data. So depending on two things, depending on the census data will depend on how many seats we can have. If all Māori people, you can choose to be on the Māori roll or on the general roll. If all Māori were on the Māori roll, we would have 14 or 15 seats in Parliament. At the moment, we have seven. So we have seven electorate areas, which are huge. My electorate is 780 kilometres from one end to the other. And so that's a bit of an issue, trying to get round to all of the constituents and making sure that we're meeting the issues that they have. But it also gives us a voice in Parliament. We're pretty outspoken. One of the things I tried to do was get a motion of the House to condemn the forced closures of Aboriginal communities in Australia and have the government sign up to that. It didn't go through. Some of the national government members objected to that, but it got attention. And sometimes you need to do things that are a bit provocative to bring light and attention to the issues.
Most certainly.
And hopefully we'll get to talk more about the forced closures a bit later, but I was interested in, I read your maiden speech and you made several really strong comments in support of the Māori seats. For example, you said when there are no longer disparities, then we can remove the Māori seats. When Māori are recognised as value added to our country and not merely entertainment fluff to be rolled out on special occasions, then we can remove the Māori seats. Is there a debate in New Zealand about removing them? And what situation would it leave Māori in if they were to be removed, do you think?
Yeah, well, absolutely. There is the national government actually platformed on a campaign back in 2008, I think, to remove the Māori seats and gotten votes that way. There was a bit of a fervour for anti-Māori sentiment, saying that Māori were privileged and that they had more rights than other people. And we just laughed and said, would you like some of our privilege? Mm. And we live 8 years less on average than non-Māori. Only 15% of us make it to retirement age, pay your whole life to put taxes in taxes, and then you get to retirement and actually you don't.
Yeah.
So you don't get to benefit from that. So we actually want the retirement age lowered. Everyone else wants to put it up.
Similar time here.
Yeah.
Here. Ours is 15 to 20 years shorter here. Though with a stroke of a pen, they Rudd brought it down to 9 years with a stroke of a pen. And that was just rubbish.
You have
a stroke of a pen.
Some communities, for example, with Kenya and New South Wales, where the average life expectancy for an Aboriginal male is 37 years. So,
yeah, yes.
Yeah, can
look. Yeah, it's appalling. I've heard statistics in New Zealand, just in by communities. It depends where you live; those statistics change. But one community here in New Zealand, the average life expectancy was 45.
Mm. Wow!
I couldn't believe it.
Marima, I'm interested. When you look, I mean, I always consider Australia fundamentally worse on race relations and the way they treat Aboriginal people than New Zealand. But when you look at what New Zealand has, for example, a treaty, a stronger form of land rights, Maori representation in Parliament, but you still have these really devastating statistics. Yeah. Why do you think that is a treaty?
It's a backlash of colonisation. The treaty wasn't recognised for more than 100 years. For 130 years, there was no recognition of the treaty. It was called a nullity in the law.
Wow.
And so they fought for the recognition of the treaty. So we still have to overcome the backlash of colonisation and assimilation and now institutionalised racism in this country, and institutionalised in the way that people don't recognise it. They call it structural discrimination because they're not even... If you call it institutionalised racism, nobody wants to talk about it. Go, no, that doesn't exist. sorry, I lost my voice on karaoke the other night.
more things in common with Currys and Murrays. We love karaoke over here.
Don't we? It fills the soul. It's one thing we can do and do well and get recognised for it. But you know what? So people say it doesn't exist. We can't even start talking about it because the words are abhorrent. So it's more, people have more appetite to call it structural discrimination. Call it what you like. What it means is that inherently people think of Māori in deficit terminology. Yeah. So a local council that has 60% Māori population in their geographic area, don't look at those figures and go, great, we've got 60% Māori population, that's fantastic. They go, oh no, what are we going to do?
They see it as a threat. You know,
Yeah, they see it as a threat, absolutely. Mm. And so just for the mere fact that you think that way, that is institutionalised racism. Now, we've got teachers who, I mean, and these are conversations, literal conversations that I've had with teachers who say to me, you know what, if it wasn't for me, these kids would all be in jail. And I'm just trying to save them from being in jail. I'm like, oh, my goodness. So in her heart, she's trying to do the right thing. In her heart, she believes she's making a difference. But actually, you already underestimate the value and the worth of our tamariki if you believe you're the only thing stopping them from going to jail.
Yeah. That's,
white saviour complex. It's very similar over here, that the burden of low expectations on Aboriginal children and how it goes on to affect their life and the current government policies about punishing parents rather than to get their children to school. It's a very similar situation.
Yeah. And I mean, we've put some legislation through here. Well, I haven't, but legislation here in this country has gone through about being able to take parents to court if their children don't go to school. I mean, but that's standardised across the country for all people and it's hardly ever enacted. But, you know, what we need to be doing is what I think the Ministry of Education have got right here is a focus on language, culture and identity. By law in New Zealand, all schools in their charter, school charter, must outline how they plan to meet the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi.
That's a big win for Māori because there was a time similar to ours when you weren't allowed the education in language. It had to be all done in English. There was that time similar to here.
Well, it wasn't just you weren't allowed the language of
weren't allowed the education.
Māori. You weren't allowed to speak it at all. Mm-hmm. So you'd be strapped if you just were talking to your cousin or your mate in te reo. Whipped, strapped, caned, whatever you want to call it. Mm. I call it abuse. But also by law, for 100 years, you had to teach Māori in the native schools that were established, cooking, cleaning, labouring, and nursemaiding. That was it. That's all you're allowed to teach. You were not allowed to teach by law academic subjects to Māori because they were not capable of learning. In fact, the conversation that they had in Parliament in 1867 at the time was that they needed to learn in a language that was more conducive to human thought, of which Māori was identified as not being.
And more conducive to assimilation and wiping out the culture.
That was what they wanted to do. Mm. In order for you to be successful, you have to be like us. So you leave your Māoriness at the door. But, you know, the Education Department, we have a Māori Minister of Education now, Hekia Parata, who has wants equitable outcomes for all students, no matter who you are. And by doing so, you need to have targeted assistance. So she's implemented national standards in New Zealand. People hate them. They go, we shouldn't be doing this to our kids and da-da-da-da-da. Teachers hate them. It's a lot of bureaucracy and a lot of paperwork. And I'm going, well, actually, I love them. And that's not the popular view. I'm not about populist politics. But it's because this is the first time we've ever had running statistics in every school that has to be reported of Māori achievement. So now we can get a picture and say, you know what, your school and the same kids from the same communities in your school, Māori students are not performing at the same rate as your non-Māori students. How can we help you fix that?
I was just going to say, I mean, it's so different from Australia where the focus is overwhelmingly on truancy and school attendance and actually not on achievement and actually bringing Aboriginal kids up to that same level of education. I mean, has there ever been that overwhelming focus on specifically truancy in New Zealand?
There's also the penalising of parents.
There is still a focus on truancy, but there is still a focus on truancy here. We've just started a new program to address truancy. But it's about doing it in a way that is culturally appropriate. There are reasons kids don't come to school, so we have to change the script. Now, there's a great couple of researchers and educationalists here in New Zealand called Mede Berryman, and oh my goodness, his name has just gone out of my head. That's disgusting. I'll think of it, I'll tell you. But they started talking about changing the script, that deficit theorizing. The way you speak indicates the way you feel and the way you teach. So let's change the way we speak about our students. So we no longer say that you're failing, we say you're being underserved by your education system. So our students have been underserved by the system. They're not failures. I mean, because no student is a failure. What the failure is our ability to teach them in an effective way that resonates with them so that they can achieve.
I would love...
We need to change what we do, not what they do.
That's so true, and I would love Prime Minister Tony Abbott to understand that same thing, I think.
Right.
It would change a lot of things in Australia in regards to Aboriginal education.
That researcher, I've just remembered, his name is Russell Bishop. I should never have forgotten that. Absolutely pioneering in the way he did things, and he had an expansive study and program that went out to a number of schools with high Māori populations called Kotahitanga, the oneness. I'm trying to find a Pākehā word or an English word that translates well. And he went into schools and he worked with teachers and improved teacher effectiveness. The way in which we communicate, build relationships with our students, mostly effective with Māori and Pacifica students, to make a change in the classroom.
What role what role does the treaty play in achieving these milestones in the development of Māori education and access to land and parliamentary... parliamentary representation?
Yeah, treaty is fundamental. Mm. The treaty is absolutely fundamental. We fought for its recognition for many, many years. I mean, pioneering activists fought for it. It was before my time. It was recognised in law in 1975. The Waitangi Tribunal was established in 1986, I think. And you were able to take retrospective claims of against the government. So we call them the Waitangi Tribunal claim. And iwi could take, tribes could take claims against the government for wrongful, wrongful law, wrongful doings against the tribe that left them bereft, landless, and then the government. So it's a tribunal, it's a court. Mm-hmm. A judge sits on it, historians sit on it, the people have to put their case to the court, and many of our tribes spend 30 odd years and more putting together the history and collecting the oral histories, which is difficult to do, but they get it together and present their submission in front of the tribunal. The Crown come and defend their situation. They always lose because they did do a whole lot of horrible injustices to our people. And then they go into negotiation. Negotiation is about, we can't give all your land back. Any land that is sold into private ownership can never be returned. But we can, if we've got government lands available in your area, return that to you. Also compensation, monetary compensation. But the estimate is about 1%. In fact, in New Zealand, I think there have been 76 land claims and tribal claims have been settled. The total amount of all monies paid out was less than the financial package given to Southern Canterbury Finance, who got $1.3 billion. So all of the claims settled add up to less than that. So it's quite significant if you're a tribe to be able to have some funds that you can then develop an asset base, like Kaitahu in the South Island, the biggest geographical area, biggest claim, I think got about $150 million, $120 million.
Wow.
There's dispute about that. They're now a $1 billion company. They just finished building 2,000 houses in the Christchurch area. They had a number of land blocks returned to them, which they built those land houses on, homes on. They have one of the biggest asset holdings of buildings in Christchurch. They are working with, in fact, they are the ones who restored the district council offices and buildings after the earthquake. And so they work with groups in Christchurch. They have a memorandum of understanding with schools in the South Island that they will uphold the tribal, you know, commitments to tribal knowledge being imparted to students. It just goes from good to better.
Oh, that's fantastic. So, what was the outcome? I may have missed it. What was the outcome of that argument or the proposal by the government with the foreshore lands acquisitions and stuff? What was the outcome?
The Labor Party put that law through, and the National Government agreed with the Māori Party when they went into coalition with them to repeal it. So one of the conditions of going into an agreement of confidence and supply with the National Government was to have that law repealed, in which they did. They established a different law, which so it wasn't complete repeal where it was non-existent and Māori could go back to the way it was. But they established a different law, the marine and some legislation, which meant that Māori could prove title and then have access to foreshore and seabed. But you had to prove title. Mm. Couldn't just rock up somewhere and say, yep, this is ours. You have to show that you've actually lived there and those sorts of things.
A continuing connection.
You have that opportunity.
That.
Yeah. So you have that opportunity now where you didn't before.
I'm interested in the issue of compromise. Now that the Māori Party does have that agreement with the Nationals, are there ever situations where you just simply cannot compromise on certain issues?
Yeah, we vote against them. So if we don't agree, we vote against them. Now, since Winston Peters won his seat in a by-election here in New Zealand, in Northland, when one of the MPs was sacked from the National Government and lost his seat. Wasn't sacked, I think he resigned, sorry, better get that right. There was a by-election in that electorate and Winston Peters won it, which meant the government had a lesser majority. They if we vote with the opposition for any reason, the two of us, the government now only has a majority of one. So right. They would prefer that we vote with them, and that's brought our bargaining power right up. So before, they had a bit of a buffer. They had a majority of two. So they knew they were pretty home and hose and they didn't need our votes. That meant that we could vote any way we liked and didn't really bother them. Now, because they only have a majority of one, we actually have quite a few ministers coming to talk to us and go, oh, what do you think about this and da-da-da-da-da, which means we now can say, well, in principle, we like most of this. We don't like this, but we don't like that. But can we discuss that further? And we are starting to get a number of wins and pieces of legislation because of that. Mm. Now, they might be small. Comparatively, these are not huge policy decisions. These are just bits of legislation. So, for example, the human rights legislation is under review here in New Zealand. The minister wanted to restructure the human rights commissioners. So you'd have one principal commissioner and then you'd have a number of other small ones who may have a portfolio of three or four things. Well, the Race Relations Commissioner was going to be one of those who would have a sort of a watered-down focus on race relations because he would have to pick up, or she would have to pick up, other portfolios and look at maybe disabilities and equal opportunities for women and things like that. So we said, well, actually, we don't like that. Sorry, we can't support you if you do that because... there are a number of issues in this country according to race, and until those issues are negated, then we think you need to have a race relations commissioner whose sole job is to look at the issues in this country according to race. Mm-hmm. And so we went back and forward for 6 months about that, but we've won that one, so we've pushed that one through now because we've had a greater negotiating power.
Great.
When we disagree, we simply vote against them. Mm. And they've had a few slim wins lately They've only had the votes by one.
Marama, what percentage of Māori engage in the elections and what percentage of Māori support? I mean, you're similar to our mob over here. There are people that are very keen to get on with the assimilation process and forget about the culture and the language and the politics and stuff, just don't rock the boat, comply. What sort of percentage do you think you have of Māori supporting Māori Party over there and engaging in the actual elections and stuff?
Well, total of the country, we only had 1.3% of the total country vote. Of all those that voted, we got 1.3%.
Māori or total population? Māori.
Total population.
1%.
So 1.3. Yep.
Okay.
So it's reducing, and there was a big push at the last election from Māori to change the government, and so the popular rhetoric that actually made it through was that in order to change the government, we need to vote for the other major opposition party, and that will give them a greater chance of getting in. There was also the campaigning that said a vote for us is a vote for National. And so a lot of that resonated with our people. I need to work really hard to ensure people understand that that's not actually true. If you don't vote, one, you may as well vote to stay the same, keep the government that we've got. Two, if you give your vote to the opposition and they don't get in, it's happened this last election, you've just wasted your vote, pretty much. What a waste of time having, because out of the seven seats, we only actually have one of the Māori seats. We have six Labour Party MPs who are Māori, who, while they're great and they speak out a lot about a lot of things, they don't actually get to make any changes or to get have any influence over the government to get things through.
Well, they have to comply with party policies, don't they?
And they have to comply with party policy. And so at the moment, when you're in opposition, that's fine because they pretty much say anything to get people on side, right? I mean, it's the way it goes.
Yeah.
But once you're in government, Māori people, our experience is they get thrown under the bus if it's a decision between what's popular and what's right. For Māori, popular will win every time. And the people win in a country that is inherently suffers from structural discrimination, then Māori are going to come out on the tail end of that. Now, what's happening to that the young man, or he's not that young anymore, but the Australian AFL player, Goods, is it?
Yeah, Adam Goods.
Adam Goods, yeah. People go, well, it's not racist, not racist. Of course it is.
Of course it is.
And since when? Who are all the commentators saying that it's not racist?
Yes, white.
Middle-aged white guy.
Exactly.
Anya.
Yep.
Anya.
How dare they see themselves, or they set themselves up to pass judgment on what's racist and what's not? My mother taught me a long time ago. She said, son, it was we as females, we as women of the world, that pointed out to you males what was sexist. We males could not identify sexist behaviour, language, and so on. Well, racism is the same. It's only people
of colour.
It is only people of colour that can determine and detect and identify racist views and attitudes. And here we have white, predominantly white males setting themselves up there as like today, that blonde-haired cricketer full of Botox
Shane
and
Warne.
Stuff, Shane Warne. Former Australian cricketer.
I didn't have to say the name. Everyone knows it.
He's up there saying, "Oh, get over it, Goodsy. Just do what you're good at.
Toe the line, boy.
Comply. They don't like a black that gets a bit uppity and starts to rock the boat. While if you're good at boxing or sport or whatever, you just continue on in that role. Now, don't get too uppity and step outside your boundaries.
That's right.
It's just pathetic.
And all of that language is completely indicative of racist attitudes.
Of course.
But they don't know it.
The
problem is that they don't know it.
That's right.
And actually, you know, there are our own people, there are Māori people in this country who don't want anything to do with being Māori because they see it as a deficit, because that's what we've been told. You know, that law that I spoke about before, the Native Schools Act, where you weren't allowed to speak Māori and you only could be do labouring and all of those sorts of things. That law stayed in place in this country for 100 years, till 1969. Now, I know there are similar things going on over there. I said, what does that do to a people? To be told your language is not good enough, your culture is not good enough. I mean, in Australia, you guys, the Aboriginal people there, the blackfellas, the mob over there, were declared non-human
by
the Pope.
That's right.
In the 1800s, 1860 or something, declared non-human. It's just absolutely abhorrent. What does that do to people?
That's certainly.
To be told that over and over and over again, that you're no good, you're worthless. That actually, in order for you to be successful, you have to be like us. We need to wipe you out.
Exactly.
But then I always say, what does it do to the other people? What does it do to the people who also grow up listening to that? Does it make them believe that they are more entitled, that they are better, that they are more privileged?
The white supremacy attitude?
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things are ingrained into their psyche as much as this deficit modelling is ingrained into our psyche. Now, I don't blame people for that. That happened a long time ago. It is perpetuated in this day and age by people who continue to do things just like the media are doing to Adam Goods at the moment.
Mm.
But what we need to do is educate and overcome. I'm not going to blame our people who stand up and say, I don't want my kids to know anything about being Māori.
No, you can't blame them. But this is colonisation, and the impact of colonisation on first peoples, on original people, the impact of colonisation on original people, but also the impact today of colonisation of the colonisers themselves, their own people.
Exactly.
That is where the problem lies, and they don't realise that colonisation, the processes of colonisation, the policies are still alive and well today. They think a colonisation finished back in 1800 or 1820 or whatever, but it is still alive and impacting so seriously and so negatively on mainstream Australians, on dominant culture.
Yep. But you know what? if Australian people knew and understood, you would get a swing away from that behaviour, because inherently people are good people.
Oh, yes.
Right? Inherently they are.
Yes.
And when they learn and hear and understand, then they have a heart and mind shift.
For sure.
Now, all of that takes. So one of the things we've done as a Māori Party is to ensure a program called Māori History in Schools.
Mm.
Okay? So we get that in. The other thing we've done is a thing called Tātaiako, Cultural Competencies for Teachers. Mm-hmm. So in order for you to be able to effectively engage with the Māori kids sitting in your class, these are the cultural competencies that you need to know and understand. Now, that has been out for a long time. There is also a policy called Māori Succeeding as Māori. That's the catch cry of the policy, Māori succeeding as Māori in schools.
Mm-hmm.
So where you don't have to leave your cultural identity at the door in order for you to achieve in your school, and that schools are required to ensure that happens. That policy is called ka hikitia. So, and these policies, some of them have been sitting on shelves in schools gathering dust, but more and more teachers, principals are pulling them off the shelves, looking into them and going, yeah, you know what? We have a moral obligation in this country to ensure every student, not just the Māori students, but every student has an understanding of the cultural identity of our native Indigenous culture. But you've got to get heart and mind shift for that to start to resonate and grow amongst the community.
That's very true, the power of education. And when we talk about Adam Goods, we are talking about almost that casual racism that's very easy to identify. When you think about institutionalised racism, like what you were talking before, it leads to policies like the forced closures of Aboriginal communities,
yes,
up to 120 Aboriginal communities. When you heard about that, were you shocked looking at Australia? Was that your perception of Australia, seeing that a policy like that could even be spoken about?
Oh, look, not shocked, and not just because it was Australia. Similar things have happened here, similar, like you can't get, not completely similar, but you can't get a benefit in some towns if you live in those towns because there's no prospect of jobs,
yeah,
right? And they say, well, that's not about race, but actually it's the Māori towns. So same thing. So I guess not shocked that it could happen, but shocked that people believed so vehemently in it. And then the media beat up that followed it about, oh, this is about child abuse. I was thinking, well, geez, if it was about child abuse, wouldn't you shut down every Catholic school?
That's very true. And you
in
couldn't
Australia,
get...
I mean, I'm not trying to be rude to Catholics at all.
No, not at all.
Please.
But that's the reality of what's happening in this country today. That's the reality of it, yeah. It has been happening for a long time.
That's the news media we see, right?
Yes.
That there was this big inquiry into the Catholic schools in Australia the pastorate were not being prosecuted for those crimes against children. So if that's the case, if you apply that standard of, you know, kids suffering child abuse, well, wouldn't you close those schools down? Come on,
yep.
You've got to apply it fairly. And actually, if you understood language, culture and identity, the best place for them to be is on their traditional lands. But we need to support those places to grow and to be independent and to have what they need. I couldn't believe, you know what shocked me? I could not believe that there was a law in Australia that said you could not make money from your traditional land without getting some sort of authorization. So you can live on it, you just can't make money off it.
Yeah, yeah, yes. Yeah, the Native Title Act is in place today, and it's very much like that. Yeah, you can go out and hunt and gather and what have you, but you can't build economic bases and things.
You have to make an agreement with the mining companies,
yes,
largely.
Yeah. Marama, you
Isn't
have
it
some...
disgusting?
It is. A lot of problems with Native Title. It's not land rights, so.
You have some strong views regarding the national anthem and the national flag?
Yes, you'll do. well, see, the thing is, the flag, I look at the flag and people go, It's a symbol of our national identity. And I said, well, I don't see myself in that flag.
Exactly.
What the hell is the Union Jack doing on our flag? Are we British? Oh, but we're from England. I said, well, actually. Mm. You know, and so many New Zealanders go back to Mother England and find that actually it's not their country anymore.
Yeah.
They don't recognise themselves in it. It's nice and it's lovely and it's where our people came from, but it's not mine and I don't feel like it's home.
Mm.
So why do we continue to persist and go, oh, because we're a Commonwealth. So what? So is Canada. They've got a maple leaf. Come on.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, where is the symbolism of our national identity?
Mm.
And actually, I could really care less about the flag because that doesn't tell me who I am. I have a Māori flag. Your black mob have a Māori, have an Aboriginal flag.
That's right.
And that's fantastic. It is symbolic, but if we're going to have the flag debate, the national government seem hell-bent on doing it, then let's get into that debate then. Let's have a flag that represents our duality of nationhood. And people go, oh, but we're multinational. I say, well, actually, I believe in a thing called ambiculturalism. Just like being ambidextrous. Mm. I'm ambicultural. Yes, I've been successfully colonised and assimilated. I know how to walk in your world, but do you know how to walk in mine? And there is a moral obligation to acknowledge your Indigenous people, and after that, whatever culture you bring to it, bring whatever culture you want to that. But there's only one place Aboriginal people in Australia can go to uphold their culture, and that's in this land.
Mm.
I can't go back anywhere to find my cultural roots. It's here, and if we don't keep them alive and embrace them and see them as an asset in our own country, then they will be lost. And let's start with a flag that recognises the place of our Aboriginal people, and in New Zealand, our Māori people, our Indigenous people. And then why not the national anthem?
Lincoln yes.
National. I think our national anthem is just boring, to be fair. your guys' national anthem rocks.
Oh, I wouldn't say that.
No,
oh, well, I just think that, you know, we sing ours in Te Reo Māori and that's lovely and it's fine. That's not really the debate. I bring it up as a provocative way of getting into the debate, which is constitutional reform of this country that is based on the Treaty of Waitangi as the founding document of our nation.
We'll have to get in touch with you again and talk about constitutional reform and see what your views are, because the big issue here at the moment. But right at this point in time, we have to wind up. But we'd look forward to talking to you again and getting you back on air here.
I'd love to do it, absolutely love to do it. And I just really want to acknowledge the people that I met in Brisbane and in the Gold Coast when I was there, invited over for the Matariki Ball and Māori communities. There's a lot going on for Māori communities, and I've not forgotten. We are still trying to push those things forward. And if you're listening this morning, get in touch if you want to and see where things are at. But lastly, I want to say thank you very much to the traditional people of your land, the tangata moi moia, the blackfellas, the mob in Australia. I was welcomed when I went to Brisbane in a traditional way, in a fire, we're in a smoking circle.
Yes, good one,
And it was just beautiful, really loved it. And what I loved was the two young people performing their traditional dances, speaking in their traditional language, and it was really enlightening. I loved it.
Well, thank you very much, and we hope to see you back here live in the studio your next visit. But in the meantime, we'll be on the phone and talking to you again. Thank you very much for your time, Marama.
Awesome. Thank you.
Have a great day, and keep up the great fight.
Amen.
Bye now. It's now time for River Story. Amy?
Yes, I'm looking forward to the next installment.
Here it is.
I am a river and part of the Fitzroy Basin, which is the largest coastal river system in all our...
No, I picked up the wrong one. Wouldn't you believe it? It's just not the one we need, not the one we can run. I've made a blue, and I can't even find it. I've done something wrong. Set it up wrong. Looks like we're going to have to Yeah, I don't know. Don't even know what I'm doing here with this story. We will get back to River Story on Monday. By the look of this, I just can't get hold of number five, segment five. There it is. And do we have the time? Yeah, we can play it. We don't necessarily need news.
I am a river and part of the Fitzroy Basin, which is the largest coastal river system in all our great Southland. Being on the eastern side of the Great Range, my flow was somewhat quicker than my sister rivers on the inland side. My country is also more green more often, and I have fewer dry slopes than the western water systems have. As human custodians, my clan groups burned land on a regular basis. This was common practice throughout all our country. This meant dead fuel could not accumulate and cause massive bushfires during hot seasons, whereas small, regular patchwork burn-offs do not generate enough intensity to reach high into the tree canopy. So the land was usually burnt during the colder months, sometimes at night when the air was still. This activity was carried out for thousands of years, and some of our trees now need fire to open their seed pods before they can reproduce. This regular burning determined the nature of country and reflected the care and maintenance of our custodians. As a river, I experience fire as a welcome scratch to the itch of dry grass and tree deadfall decomposing too slowly. The recycling function and cleaning action of burning is more fully realized after rain. The burnt country might experience dew and humidity before rain. Thus many shoots are already germinated and spurt quickly after the first showers. Ash is a natural fertilizer, encouraging a profusion of fresh shoots that attract many species. The herbivores bring a big variety of others, so freshly burned country is always going to become a hot spot of activity following rain. Yes, my humans kept good balance between the species and increased their abundance through reflexive management practice. The big colonial bushfires burn my skin and damage species, besides releasing much greater volumes of fire gases than the patchwork burning. When the traditional practice lapsed after the invasion, much of our land changed character. It became wild and overgrown with many of the more aggressive and faster-growing species. These more hardy plants survived the infernos better than many of the smaller and more delicate ones. The functions of the plants in providing the necessities of clean air and water is important for the balance between all systems in our country. But many people have died by fire under the colonial regime. Yet indigenous knowledge can be found whenever authorities decide to prevent the infernos. Yes, the annual bushfire season can be replaced by traditional burn-off methods at any time. However, decision-making authority belongs to leaders whose expertise includes little traditional knowledge. Still, my writer feels alarmed at the destruction caused by the colonial infernos. Why does the artificial system keep the colonials as strangers in a strange land? He knows the unnecessary destruction can be prevented almost totally in a handful of years. Surely future children are entitled to a healthy country? Is there no place for responsible land management practice in the colonial system? Who decides? Where is the duty of care towards country, species and children? As in all our Southland, my Kungaloo people and my other river clans recognise no leaders because the ancient law allowed no full adult to follow any person. The elders would tolerate no one who behaved in such a manner. Every full person needs to be responsible for their own behaviour. Seniors and knowledgeable elders would usually be consulted when matters of importance arose, and would expect to supervise certain activities according to their areas of expertise or various obligations. Certainly, they sometimes exercised great authority, but only with the consent and knowledge of all who were affected by the matter at hand. Indeed, in every part of this great Southland, the clan stories and law songs made no mention of leaders, armies, or prisons. Disputes happened between individuals and groups, and my people carried their weapons and shields for good reason. But the ancient law from the Creator Spirits was absolute. Each group was allotted a specific area as their own, forever. The various kinship and totemic laws crossed boundaries and networked the entire continent and carried strict protocols protecting all species and preventing any dispute from escalating to warfare. Yet a great catastrophic conflict did occur in the past.